Yeah, it's a great pleasure to have a talk as a speaker in our conference. I said to many, about many speakers that I do not have to introduce them because they're so well known here, but the same, it is most true. In fact, it happens that the paper that I just printed out today, your name is all over the world because this is more intimate than this is. And so it's no surprise that I that you made that couple of times. And we're looking forward to your talk and so on rather than that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's get started. So I'll begin with explaining why I need conformal symmetry in my way of thinking about gravity. Like any one of us here, I think you're all very concerned about the small distance structure of quantum gravity in particular. Something goes terribly wrong there with all our conventional ideas, unless you go into weird sort of twists of our mind. That's called string theory. But if we want to just think of gravity as an extension of all the forces that we do know, we know that there are local degrees of freedom which somehow are processed by nature and in some very systematic way. And the outcome of that is something called general relativity on the one hand, quantum gravity, and on the other hand, matter interactions. But we want to understand how these things hang together. And there's a very strong suspicion that basically all forces, once you come as close as the Planck scale, that there is a kind of limit to what can happen there. The amount of freedom or degrees of freedom that you have near the Planck scale are essentially denumerable or even very restrictive. Of course, this argument we've seen many times, that if you think of the uncertainty relation, delta x must be bigger than h bar over delta p. That's just basically the uncertainty relation of quantum mechanics. But delta p is related to the energy of the system. The energy cannot exceed the local Schwarzschild radius. And that means that there is some quantum divided by delta x, and now well, this is a delta x itself, somehow can never become smaller than the Planck length that you see here. So, and moreover, if you look at black hole physics, once you try to squeeze more information into a smaller volume, then you see you must generate something like a black hole. And the amount of information in the black hole is also limited by the black hole entropy expressions, which was a great discovery by Stephen Hawking. And all that means that you really have a finite amount of information to play around with at the Planck scale. And that is the central ingredient which I want to exploit in my theories so far in vain. So it didn't really work out the way we would like to have it. So, I can choose a too small screen here. Anyway, somehow we want a theory that describes in a natural way the microstates of a black hole without introducing a black hole as an afterthought. In most theories of gravity, also the weird ideas are going on about the small distance limit, and then there's a little footnote saying that now we have to handle also black holes. I don't like that footnote at all. I think black holes are an elementary ingredient of any theory that handles the Planck scale. Because it can rather easy to argue that black hole simply forms a part of the entire spectrum of things that you can have out there. Think of the process of formation of a black hole, and whatever the black hole does after a while, it decays. And all that should be described by a unitary amplitude called scattering matrix. So the scattering matrix has in it as spectral states things you might call a black hole or not, and it has ordinary particles and living organisms in intermediate states as well, simply everything. And a unitary condition should relate all that. So there's no reason to treat the black hole as an afterthought. It should be there from the very beginning in the theory. And it should also happen in a very natural way in such a theory. So I've been looking at this for a long time, and from earlier work, there's one very simple and easy conclusion which came out, and that is that astrophysicists have sometimes been wondering about white holes. So you have a black hole, and the time reverse on a black hole is a white hole. So a white hole is something in which nothing goes in, but later we think Hawking radiation might go in, but stars and planets and astronauts come out of the black hole. And that's a time inverse of a black hole called a white hole. Now, so this is a picture, but actually, once you realize that these things are, consist of microstates, it's rather obvious how these things are related. A black hole must be the quantum superposition of all possible white holes, and vice versa. This requires certain quantum amplitudes in the transformation. So every black hole is a superposition of white holes, every white hole is a superposition of black holes, much like particles can be in a position configuration or a momentum configuration, one is a superposition of the other. So that picture came out quite clearly, but the question is how to make a theory that has all this built in a natural way. Because it looks at first sight as if a black hole is a kind of soliton object, but it is not. It's a soliton, like a magnetic monopole in gauge theories, is always an extended object. It can't become much smaller than a certain size, and then it becomes just a regular field configuration. Black holes seem to be something much more special than that. Now, you could argue that actually black holes are nothing special in a theory at all, because I could decide to stretch my coordinate frame. After all, you could use the fact that very likely there's a mechanism called cosmic censorship. In most configurations that we know, this seems to be true, that the singularity of a black hole is hidden behind the horizon. But once you have a horizon, which would normally be described something like this, you have imploding matter, inward particle like that, outward particle like that, here is still basically all in flat space-time, but already a horizon builds up. The dotted line is the horizon. As soon as you enter into the dotted line, then you can't get up anymore. But particles that, due to quantum fluctuations, arise here, after a while, they stick to the horizon for a long time, and exponentially, they manage to wiggle their way out. And those particles are actually then seen as Hawking radiation. So, the interpretation of Hawking's result is that there are vector fluctuations here. The vector fluctuations are totally innocent. They are part of the vacuum in this region. But then suddenly, later, we are seeing real particles coming out. We have the standard arguments that explain how this hangs together with the Rinter space transformations and so on. Now, what you could do is you would simply stretch the coordinates. So you could send this central, particular singularity, you could send to time equals plus infinity. And then what you're left over with is, okay, it's still this horizon is forming present. You see ingoing particles and outgoing particles, and it seems that you're only describing space and time in a regular way. And you see what you really need is a theory that naturally explains that whatever you send into this thing eventually does come out again as Hawking radiation. And in fact, there's all reason to believe that the black hole eventually will disintegrate completely, and things will go back to normal as if the black hole never existed. So that's the kind of theory that we want to have. And this was just to say that there's a Cauchy surface. We'll still have the regular quantities that go from minus infinity to plus infinity. And so you could, in principle, think of describing the black hole just as some property of the Cauchy surface and goes through if you choose a certain foliation. Lots of talks about the difficulty, of course, the ambiguities that you have in defining the Cauchy surface. Now, so this region here is where Hawking radiation develops, but in that picture, that is the entire central region where quantum fluctuation particles may come out. So this part of the theory we want to have, I now claim that if you just start with a standard picture, then it doesn't come out like this. The standard picture, I mean, ordinary perturbative gravity, like we apply always perturbative quantum field theories in elementary particles, plus some extra stuff to describe that might happen in a non-trivial background, such as a black hole, and And then you may have matter in the usual form of a standard model or something like that. You throw all that together in one big bin, and you try to distillate your theory out of that. That would be the stand theory. Now, stand theory is completely wrong when you try to do this. I want to emphasize that, that simple picture of the theory of gravity with some description of what you do as very small distances, I don't care much what it is, somehow you define your counter terms, and some description about what happens in the absolute non-trivial background, and then all things should work. But it's not that. And we all know that the difficulties, and this is one of the greatest difficulties, describe this situation correctly. So what I eventually want to have is a picture which looks like a blasphemy. This is, if Stephen Hawking would have been here, he would now jump up in his chair. because he would say, no, it's going to be so. If you have an imploding black hole here, and it decays up there, but to describe the implosion and decay in a space-time without any singularity anywhere, that can't be right. I did say, well, the first half is right. I can touch black hole so much the singularity seems to go to infinity. And now what I do is upset, I do the opposite. At the time of Earth, I put it similarly, I put it 5 minus infinity. And somehow I glue the pieces together in the middle, and that's the black hole. But that's not what Hawking would say. He would say the similarity is a real thing, and you can't get rid of it this easy way. So something has to go when you try to make such a theory. And so you need a new ingredient. And that is the central theme of my talk today. The new ingredient will be local conformal symmetry. Let me try to explain that. But first, before going to local conformal symmetry, I'll explain how to arrive at that. And that is the notion of black hole complementarity. So what is black hole complementarity? The principle is very simple. Think of this is a part of a black hole, and you can consider an observer who goes into the black hole, but as seen from the outside, the guy will just stop right in front of the horizon and never go in. You see him being squeezed like a pancake, he comes closer and closer to the horizon, but you never see him pass through the horizon. And so that is why we can use this frame and say we never see the similarity, no matter what. Eternally, we'll sit there. And something happens with Hawking condition. But the observer himself will disagree with completely. He will go right through the horizon. So there's these two different pictures of what happens at the horizon. And now, there's the question, well, we all know what the consequence of that is. That is, they both experience time differently, and time in quantum field theory plays a very different role than time in gravity. In quantum field theory, time separates out between the positive and negative frequencies. If you do a Fourier transformation of time, you know the energy. If your Fourier modes are positive, then you are annihilating energy. If the Fourier modes are negative, you are creating energy. So time means energy. Now, in these two pictures, time is something totally different. So energy means something totally different, and therefore particles mean something totally different, and that's the origin of Hawking radiation. That's Hawking radiation in a nutshell. Now, what is black hole complementarity? It is that on one hand, you can have an ingoing observer. So here's an observer who goes in, and that observer sees all the particles that go in as well. But there's one thing this observer does not see. This observer does not see the Hawking particles coming out. So the observer has absolutely no idea that millions of particles come out of the black hole. They come out in perhaps all sorts of interesting quantum states. It's thermal, so the quantum states are being averaged over it, but you can think of a pure theory inside saying that, well, that's just a probability, but now you can try and measure to see which particles actually do come out of the black hole, and then you can attach a wave function to them. Now, the outside observer, she would see something totally different. That outside observer would see the Hawking particles coming out. But that outside observer will no longer have any information about what went into the black hole. So you have two complementary ways of describing what happens at the horizon. You can use the language of this man, Hatter, who went into the black hole, or you can use the language of Alice in Wonderland, who sees the Hawking particles coming out. And now the important ingredient that you say, well, they seem to see totally different things, but certain themes, they are both right. They are both having a different way of describing what is really going on. This is complementarity. So it's not true that Alice misses out all the things from in the black hole. The Mad Hatter here doesn't see, doesn't miss out on the population because he has access to all the parts he's going in. There are two complementary ways to describe what happens at the horizon. So that actually does not fit well in the, what I call the standard picture. If you try to do probability theory near black holes, you would see that they both miss something. The Mad Hatter doesn't see the Hawking particles, Alice doesn't see things into the black hole. So they both see half of the world. I'm saying no, they both see the entire world. That's just a complementary way. So this makes the whole picture totally different. And here is, to make this thing work, and I think you need to have it work to have a proper model of what goes on, is exactly local performing there. Let me try to explain that. So think of a black hole now in which particles enter very slowly and particles get out very slowly. I'm looking at a black hole considerably bigger than the Planck scale. At the Planck scale, you know, anything goes, you don't know. If this thing is much bigger than the Planck scale, then the standard model should say something, but what it says is wrong, so we have to correct it. And the whole point is that black hole is sufficiently large, the processes we are talking about are very slow in time. So although M2 is bigger than M1, you do have to wait for a large amount of time for that to happen. So, but the incoming observer sees that the black hole increases in mass. Now that incoming observer can do something which is a bit difficult to understand perhaps, but that incoming observer can use any coordinate frame he likes. So he can certainly look at the outside coordinates of the black hole and ask what happens there. But whatever coordinate frame the observer uses, he'll say, if I would transform this into the coordinates of the outside observer, I would see a black hole that that inflates, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, because it catches things. I don't see anything getting out of the black hole, so I see the black hole increasing in mass. Now, the outside observer only looks at the outgoing radiation, says, no, I see that M1 is bigger than M2, so the black hole decreases in mass. So the two observers whose picture was supposed to be complementary, they disagree about something. They disagree about the mass of the black hole, because they can both use any coordinate frame they like. So they can both, well, one sees only parts going in, the other sees only parts coming out. Because of that, and because of energy conservation, they cannot possibly agree about whether the mass of the black hole increases or decreases. What is going on here? This was not part of the standard picture. This is something different. So let me describe now what is different between the two observers. They can both decide to use the Kruskal coordinates. Now, Kruskal coordinates are a very important way of describing Kruskal-Siqueiros coordinates. They're very important to describe the black hole because of one thing, that the local speed of light is almost 45 degrees outward, and of course, in sideways directions as well. So the light cones are the same. The only thing in which the two observers disagree is about the mass parameter. So I write the radial coordinate as a function lambda of t times the Kruskal rho coordinate, and the mass is also time dependent. The m is a function of t, it's a lambda of t times a stationary mass. And it's the lambda of t that both observers disagree about. Now, what is that metric? Well, it's a standard Kruskal metric, but the whole thing is multiplied with lambda squared of t. Because you look carefully, and all these terms here have the same dimension, so they all either increase or decrease with lambda of t. Of course, if lambda is constant, then you're describing a black hole with a mass lambda times m. So these two observers, of whom I want to say that their views are complementary, the two observers disagree about lambda of t. And this is, of course, a local conformal transformation, because Julian said in his talk that the shape of the black hole is the same, the shape is what's in between the brackets, but the coefficient in front is different. And so that's the conformal factor that they disagree about. And now the whole idea about complementarity is that it should be an exact principle. There's nothing approximate to it. So this local conformal symmetry should be an exact property of the equations of gravity, which were not in the standard theory. This is a kind of performance theory which is not in there. So something has to be modified. And so then, we can say, well, how can you use, suppose that laws of nature were exactly invariant under local conformal transformations, how could I then use conformal, how would I look at the conformal transformations? Well, my notation is again different, I apologize, that's again different from all the other talks I've seen, but I'm certainly reassured by the fact that also all previous speakers had different notations. So, my notation is again different. In the Tesla coordinate transformation has lambda close to 1, lambda is 1 plus something in the decimal. If now ask how does the Einstein tensor transform, and that of course tells you how the energy momentum tensor transforms under this transformation, it gets second derivative terms in the transformation law. Of course, the Newton's constant has to be divided out. So you see that two observers also disagree about the energy momentum tensor. And now I say, of course, they disagree about the energy momentum tensor. One observer saw Hawking particles coming out, another observer saw particles going into the black hole. So yes, they are looking at a different energy momentum tensor. Now this is a very important argument where, again, I differ from what is usually said. Because usually people say, well, if you look at Hawking radiation, and you go to from local coordinates to global coordinates, the energy momentum tensor is zero. That cannot be right. Because obviously these particles come out as real particles, there's energy conservation, so certainly Hawking particles carry away energy and momentum. So it cannot be just that. The whole point is that if you compute the energy momentum tensor of Hawking radiation in the Rindler space, you get zero or a very small number, only if you assume these Hawking particles to be in a quantum mechanically mixed state. Now the whole point about that is we want to go beyond the mixed state description. We want to go to the pure quantum state description. We want to describe the black hole as a pure quantum mechanical phenomenon. So we want to get rid of these mixed states. But as soon as you put the energy momentum tensor or the Hawking particles in whatever pure quantum state you can think of, they will always generate a divergent energy momentum tensor on the horizon in the Rindler space. So, yes, there is a big team in from the Hawking particles, we cannot ignore it. But it's a different team in as seen by different observers. The guy who just falls into the black hole doesn't see that at all, the guy outside does see it. So if you want pure quantum mechanics, then the two complementary observers will disagree about the energy momentum tensor. And therefore, they disagree about the metric of space-time, and that disagreement can be cast into anything, but I want, first of all, that is in the conformal factor only. The reason for that is that the conformal factor is the easiest thing to think of as being gauge dependent. If you take the rest of the metric tensor gauge dependent above, that would be even a bigger blasphemy. But if you would do that, then also the light cones would become gauge dependent. And I have difficulty with that because I do want to understand how causality functions in such a theory. And I do want the two different observers to have the same notion of causality. So the thing I've been trying, and I think that is an interesting trial, is to assume that these two observers, the Mad Hatter and Alice, they see very different things, but they see the same light cones. If that is so, then only the conformal factor is definitely something that they disagree about. So what I can do now is I can say, wait a minute, if T mu behaves like this, I can do something which I have not seen any of the previous speakers do so far. Usually, the speaker said, well, we fix the determinant of G mu to be 1. That fixes lambda, all right? Or we fix lambda to be trivial. Then that it also fixes the gauge. I am going to choose yet another gauge choice. I choose one of the 10 components of the T mu to vanish. That gives you a differential equation for lambda. By the way, it's a second order differential equation, which means that if you have a locally a flat space, then if lambda is a linear function of the coordinates, then the right-hand side vanishes with first approximation. That linear lambda is a generator of special conformal transformations, the ordinary global conformal transformations, under which indeed the vacuum is invariant. Because if I make a local conformal transformation here, all people in the room will feel very uncomfortable, but the flat space remains flat space. So that's why there's a second derivative there, that the generator of global performance oscillations leaves the whole condition there. But I can choose one quarter of T mu and then solve the differential equation and get this way a gate constraint on lambda. That, I claim, is a very interesting gauge choice. Let's look at it in the case of the black hole with its good stuff for orbits. So the Einstein tensor transforms this way. If I have the Kruskal force there and I multiply the whole thing with exponentiated thing now e to the mu, because that is calculationally easier here. So I write e to the mu and then I write the Einstein tensor or all most trivial components there. And you see that gxx only depends on d mu dx, gyy depends on d mu dy. And the other two depend on more complicated combinations of the two. So what I can do now is I can choose as a gauge the so-called black hole gauge. The black hole gauge has TYY equals zero. That black hole has a mu, but then for positive reasons only will increase. And the white hole gauge has TXX equals zero. So this means the guy sees no Hawking particles. This guy sees nothing going into the black hole. But now that is a gauge-dependent statement. So this is the kind of theory that I want to see activated at the Planck scale, because now both observers can be right. It's only a question of choosing a different gauge. So the transformation from black hole to white hole is a gauge transformation. By the way, the transformation of black hole to white hole also is described by a scattering matrix. If you have all the ingoing states, they go into the black hole. All the outgoing states come out of the black hole. So a S matrix is a matrix that relates all ingoing particles to all outgoing particles by unitary transformation. So basically, the gauge transformation here to here should generate the scattering matrix of that black hole. So that's the kind of theory which I want to see realized. And you're also seeing that I paid a price. I said that somehow the conformal component in the metric tensor should be invisible. You also see that I think it's pretty compelling that you need such a symmetry here to make black holes work properly. So when string theorists say that they all better get black hole and everything works perfectly in string theory, my suspicion is that string theory has hidden in it this kind of conformal symmetry. Of course, as you know, in supergravity and string theory, people work a lot with these conformal transformations as well. So now there's a piece I can go through it quickly, because it has been handled by several other speakers, notably Yitzhak Pars has basically went through the same thing, so I can go through it quickly. I split up the metric tensor into two parts. An omega part, a previous speaker had capital omega there, Yitzhak had phi there. I have a lowercase omega, but it's the same thing. And g hat, another speaker had g bar, but it's again the same thing. But you put the restricted internal g hat, this is a special disciplinary goal, where I thought that you had to restrict the internal g hat to be 1. That's one possible gauge choice. But you can choose any other gauge choice you like. But you split the degrees of freedom into parts, where g hat describes all the light cones, omega describes the scales, mass scales, and so on. Now you can, of course, ask how come that atoms have adapted size, that the solar system has a size, galaxies have a size, everything in the world has a size. How come that you can say such a silly thing that size is gauge dependent? Of course it isn't. Well, that is because we are used to put these atoms and these planets and these galaxies in a surrounding space-time that is flat. That means that at infinity, omega is always tuned to be 1. And we are used to talk about atoms, but we always forget that space-time could be curved. As soon as you do that, then you have definite size. This is the statement that the vacuum breaks conformal symmetry spontaneously. And I want to stretch that local conformal dance is a spontaneous conformal symmetry, just like the Higgs mechanism in Gauge theory. It's a local symmetry spontaneous problem. So this conformal transformation has to be looked upon just like the Gauge transformations in weak interaction theory, where Higgs does exactly the same job as the Mobile. In fact, that was also in Mitchell's talk. So if you have transformations that leave the equation g mu equals eta mu, this is flat space, unchanged, then you have the global performance transformations. So now let's go through this quickly. I replace the function integral of gravity into two parts, integral indicating over g hat, indicating over omega. And suppose, this is again one of the earlier trials, I did, suppose you integrate over omega first and look at the remainder. Now, if you integrate over omega first, omega represents all the conformal transformation you do. If you integrate over the entire conformal group, the remainder should be automatically conformally invariant. Well, you have to watch out with this statement because the conformal group is not a compact group. It's omega not the minus infinity plus infinity. So, because of that, this integral is not as simple as it seems. And indeed, there are also causes for trouble, but we come to that. So, you would think then that you get an effective action in terms of g hat only, which by its very construction is conformally invariant. That is beautiful, because if my action, my effective action is conformally invariant, it should be denormalizable. It's even better than denormalizable, it's finite in a sense. In the same sense that people call n equals 4 super young Mills and other theories finite because they're conformally invariant. And some people think that conformally invariant is the same thing as finite. So it should be renormalizable. That's great. Here comes the renormalizable theory of quantum gravity. But unfortunately, that's not true. And why is it not true? Well, this conformal group is not a compact group. So this this integration is full of infinities. And yes, sure, if you integrate over omega, you encounter infinities. However, those infinities are very mild ones. They're only logarithmic. And that is a problem with theorists. I say, yes, logarithmic infinities are the most obnoxious ones. So you're in trouble. And of course, this is not a renormalizable theory of gravity. There are anomalies, and there are quite a few of them. I usually dwell a little bit more on these anomalies, but I want to be very short about them now. So basically, here on top you have again my Lagrangian. I think of having a scalar field phi and a scalar field omega. Now, my omega is zigzags phi, this phi here is zigzags s. And the argument goes exactly the same, so I'm just repeating what he says. So I can be very quick about it. So the whole thing is that in the entire Lagrangian, in terms of that omega field, if omega is a dynamical field, the entire Lagrangian is conformally invariant by construction. So this is a built-in conformally invariant in quantum gravity. If you choose omega to be dynamical, it's conformally invariant. If you say this symmetry is spontaneously broken, omega is in vacuum is 1 rather than 0, then you say it's a Higgs mechanism, but you recover immediately the old Einstein-Hilbert theory of gravity. However, if you look at the most divergent part of the expression, well, I usually describe divergence in terms of dimensional renormalization. You get a 1 over 4 minus n if you are in n dimensions. And if n goes to 4, that's of course infinite because it's in the denominator. So, and what's in the right hand side between the brackets are all the nasty terms you get. The g hat field generates a curvature r hat, and the phi field, well, if there's any background phi field, then you get the term phi to the fourth. And I skipped a few technicalities here, so it's a bit difficult to understand, but you find that the conformal anomaly here, the r mu squared and minus 1 third r squared, is basically a conformally invariant anomaly. You can see that only if you subtract a topological term, the Gauss-Jeanette term, because the Gauss-Jeanette term and the original calculation both contain the full Riemann tensor squared, but then you can remove that to get a simpler expression, and that's what I usually do, to simplify things. I have here ignored the Gauss-Jeanette term. That's not quite right. I learned from different discussions of people who work on anomalies much, much longer, but just for simplicity. And there's a five to fourth. The coefficient from there becomes, from that diagram, gets a correction from the omega integration. The omega integration, the omega sits in can run around in the loop like that. and these two XL lines could be two phi lines. So the mass squared of the phi field will, in the one loop divergent diagrams, will be squared. And also, if you put all the coefficients in, you get Newton's constant times the mass squared as a counter term, and then phi to the fourth. Phi to the fourth is conforming invariant. G times m squared, so Newton's constant times m squared, is also a scale independent quantity. It's a dimensionless quantity, usually very small. And so the whole thing is conforming invariant and dimensionless. But it has this nasty 1-0 format n in front. And if you interpret that in terms of a cutoff in the theory, then 1-0 format n behaves like a log of a cutoff. It always goes like this in quantum field theory. And where k is some residual effect that you get by having n not exactly equal to 4. So this whole thing is not conforming invariant, and that's why this whole expression fails to be conforming invariant. This is the conformal anomaly in a nutshell. Now, when I talk to people who come together, who have done this much longer, say we see other conforming invariant, conformal anomalies, there are actually two independent coefficients. I won't raise this one, but actually there are two. But I thought this was the most important one, because this, the one I wrote down, is the one that if you do not integrate over G hat. But in most theories, people do integrate over G hat as well, and they get more anomalies. So, now, one question is, could we cancel out this anomaly? And in my case, I cannot. Like, if I don't integrate over G hat, I cannot cancel out the anomaly. And the reason is, we all get the same sign. If you look at the contribution from scalar fields, from Dirac spinor fields, from vector fields, they all get positive coefficients. And there's no way I can put in scalars and spinors and vectors so those coefficients cancel. But supergravity people, they are afraid of nothing. They put even spin three halves in here, and they find a negative coefficient. So maybe with gravitinos you can do the job. But then you have to, first you have to marry supersymmetry. And that's a big step you need to make. So I don't believe in gravitons. Well, maybe I have to believe it to make this anomaly cancel. I don't know. The tensor field, so that's really the G hat field, also gives a positive contribution. So maybe you need supergravity to make these anomalies cancel. If people do supergravity, they often find that the anomalies cancel because of supergravity. So that's but actually there are two kinds of anomalies. One is if you have a curved background, so two anomalies which all have cancel on a series of work. But there's also meta fields. And now, in the meta fields, you get much more anomalies. And that was one of them I already had on the screen, just a 5/4 term that you get from having the omega going to a loop. And then you get 5/4 in external lines. So that is also an anomalous term that renormalizes the 5/4 interaction. Again, it's a logarithmic correction that violates conformed symmetry. Well, anybody who has some experience in quantum field theory knows exactly what this means. These are the renormalization group coefficients. So the beta function comes exactly from this is a miscellaneous remark, but I wrote the mark down with them when Yitzhak talked about his element in terms of all these fields and anomalies. I want to keep in. Basically, if you do the splitting as I said, you get that the contribution from G hat to the action just cancels out completely. There is no relic G hat term in the action, not in the tree, in the bare action, because that wouldn't be conforming there at all. That would scale in the wrong way. But the Einstein-Hilbert action just is replaced by a contribution of the omega field, and that of the elemental tensor that happens to coincide with the Einstein tensor. And what you find is that dl the g hat must now be zero because g hat doesn't occur in the action. Well, not quite zero, it's the energy momentum tensor at the right hand side. The energy momentum tensor which comes by differential dl omega, l matter with respect to g hat. But since g hat doesn't occur in the Lagrangian itself, the right-hand side now is zero. Instead of isolation, we get that the energy momentum tensor due to the omega field plus the energy momentum tensor due to the meta field must vanish. That means any one tensor of the order of field is negative. That's the famous minus sign you see everywhere happening in the conform factor of gravity. So yes, the T omega is negative, T matter is positive, together this all stands up to zero. The T of omega is simply the Einstein tensor. So this is just Einstein's equation in this guys. So that's just the way you have to look. Here you have Einstein's equation there. But now you see that that T of omega necessarily has a different sign. So you see that this, the wrong sign is not really the wrong sign. It has to be like that, because otherwise this equation couldn't come out. Actually you can read this question two ways. You can either differentiate with G hat or G mu itself. You get the same features. This is, I think, a very interesting aspect of what we're talking about. I haven't seen this yet before in the other talks. If you want the conform anomalies to cancel, you also must have them cancel in the matter interactions. And that, as I just said, is the beta function, the realization group. How much time do I have?
Yeah, 10 minutes.
Oh, then I can just briefly go into the... Here you see the standard model. You see the standard model very quickly. Here it comes. It was historically, it didn't quite develop that fast. standard model, or something like that. Think of the matter interaction described as something like this. But a great big extension that LHC should find when opening in the future, and all the future accelerators, until they reach the Planck scale, they all will modify the standard model. So this is not the final word at all. You have to wait and see what happens once you reach close to the Planck scale. Then you have the final standard model. That model, whatever that is, I tended to believe that it consists of three parts. It consists of scalar parts, vector parts, and spinor parts. And I now take G hat for a moment to be zero. I'm going to look at those anomalies that remain when I look at the flat background space time, except my omega field will be there. So the conformal transformation will be there, but the rest of the background I keep flat. So then the conformal numbers disappear. I get the ordinary Lagrangian for a standard model, which contains Young Mills part, including, of course, the Maxwell theory. This was Einstein-Hilbert action, which is translated into the omega field now. Yes, this 1/6 times square lambda omega to the fourth, or that's the cosmological constant. D mu omega squared is basically the Einstein-Hilbert action. What I left out is R times omega squared itself, so the R terms, which are there for conformal variance, those were left out of the expression, so you don't see the Einstein-Hilbert action anymore. But supposedly there in covariant limitation. Kappa tilde is 1/6 of the usual kappa term. It's not 8 pi gn, but 4/3 pi gn, because this 6 always is this famous 6 you get when you do a transformation in the Einstein-Hilbert action. And they're all in scalar fields. The scalar fields may have mass terms, but there's also, in principle, you could have a cubic scalar coupling. It doesn't occur on the standard model itself, but maybe in some future versions you have scalar fields with cubic terms. They have to make them all conformally covariant. You have to multiply this with omega squared and then with omega. And then there could be fermions. They kind of explicit Yukawa couplings with all the Higgs fields, whatever it is. And then there could be a mass term for the fermions. Again, not in the ordinary standard model, maybe in some extended standard model with seesaw neutrinos or something like that. But anyway, this is the most general possibility that you have. Now, I want to stress that all parameters in the theory are dimensionless, including the mass terms. Look at the mass terms, they're all multiplied by appropriate factor of kappa, which is the Newton's constant. Mm-hmm. So, by construction, the entire theory is completely conformal in depth. And now I insist that the conformal anomalies cancel out. And they don't, if you don't break up. So now, since all these coefficients are dimensionless, you have a large crowd of beta functions to compute. All these things come with beta functions. Oh yes, and the top term there, which is the circle around, that's the cosmological term. The cosmological term goes like omega to the fourth. Piaget said that also. So the cosmological constant also becomes dimensionless because it multiplies by a kappa squared in a dimensionless combination. So everything here is dimensionless. So this is a conformally invariant theory in flat space time. All quantum field theorists know how to compute the beta function for such a theory. It's a lot of work, but you can compute it. And now I'm saying this beta function must be zero. Well, we know in quantum field theory, there's a beta function for every running coupling constant in this system. And all coupling constants, all dimensions coupling constants, here could be running coupling constants, they're all controlled by a beta function. In other words, I have as many beta functions as I have coupling constant theory. And that includes mass terms and cosmological terms. So this means that if I impose the condition all these beta functions cancel, I have exactly as many equations as I have three parameters in the standard model. This leads to a startling result, in principle, which is that all parameters should be Bayes equations. These should be isolated solutions. So I have just a single solution. All these parameters should now be calculable. And this is great news for the standard model of physics, that all its constants are calculable. Well, usually, like more talks, I'll enter the anticlimax. I would like to calculate the same, and now compute the find such constant, compute the proton electron mass ratio, compute this, compute that, compute all the Gambibbo angles, compute the scale, and everything can be computed. But it's not so easy as I'll show. These calculations are very, very hard.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
If you imagine supersymmetrizing the model, then you have fewer parameters because you have both bosons and fermions and supersymmetric. Now, some of the beta functions can cancel because of that, but themselves. So,
in fact, well, the one problem I have with that, of course, is that nature doesn't seem to be supersymmetric, and
true.
This is this kind of reality. But supersymmetry does show indeed that it can be done. If I take n equals 4 super young neurons as this model, that's a perfect example where the whole procedure can be carried out, except the solution is degenerate. Because for no matter what you substitute with a coupling constant in n equals 4 super young neurons, it's always beta 0. So now, once you have a degenerate solution, and on top of that, the model has no masses in it, what's nice about this is that you take super young neurons in there, but there's no lambda over the fourth. In the super young neurons. That means the solution has a vanishing cosmological constant. So super young neurons is a very interesting test case in this, that it's a theory where the cosmological constant has to be zero, because otherwise the beta function for the overall computing will vanish, and all the mass terms disappear, and you just have the usual super young neurons. Which of course does not describe the world as we know it, so we want to have something else. But it is a very important existence pool. At least the problem can be carried out for that particular case.
You know, the omega field can be supersymmetrized as well.
Yes, but then you go into supergravity practically.
Yeah, in supergravity.
yeah, and that's a bit out. Then you have to understand, of course, how supersymmetry is involved and all that. Yeah?
Good question. Conformally invariant gravity theory. The major momentum tension has zero trace.
Yes.
So there's no matter. So I understand that you continuously break the conformal symmetry to get matter.
Yes. Yes, it's continuously broken. This is why in ordinary life we don't see a traceless energy momentum tensor. But if you add the energy momentum tensor of the overall field, its trace is actually worse than that. It's zero altogether because. Because the omega just takes away Einstein's tensor, so it actually does a little bit too much. So, I've tried to do this problem. I couldn't stop myself from trying to see what happens if you do this for model. And you can go a long way. You have these equations to solve, these triple couplings, the mass terms, they're all made dimensional, and they all have beta functions. So how does all that work? Well, maybe there's one solution, maybe there's no solution, no non-trivial one, or maybe there's a whole landscape of solutions. What I like about it here is that this looks very much like what string theorists find. They also have a landscape of possible string configurations that seem to work. Here, with this argument, you also get a landscape of points, isolated points. You cannot make infinitesimal changes there, but you can, because the solutions here depend on the algebra theory. I can choose my gauge group, I can choose the representations of the gauge theory in the scalar case and in the fermionic case. I can choose your gamma couplings and scalar self couplings. So, and in particular the algebra, what are the local and global symmetries of the system? I choose those, and once I choose that, then I can see how I do the beta functions and see if there is a solution. So that's the problem I'm trying to do. And now.
You said earlier, for n plus 4, you have a continuous family. You
yes.
You say that's an isolated solution.
Right. So in n plus 4, it's a very special case that the solution is degenerate. Normally, when you just take any non solution, that's not the case.
So what did you impose to
I just choose the algebra, I don't know what, I just try everything. And then without any algebra you try to see if you can find the solution where all the data functions vanish. And you get as many equations as unknowns, so that's an interesting project. Maybe there are solutions, maybe not.
There are. In addition to there being so this is just a generic function of one variable in one dimensional space has generic zeros.
Yes.
Has discrete zeros. A generic function of n variables in an n dimensional space.
Yes.
Has
it's n functions from n variables which are isolated zeros.
Yeah. But don't you have other conditions? Don't you also want them to be attractive? You want them to be stable?
No, I don't want them to be attractive. There's no demand saying they're attractive. There is a demand that all coupling functions be positive and real. And that kills you usually. I'll show very briefly what the problem is here. Although we don't know, but the equation is extremely complicated. But what I said here, this just a side remark. You can ask, what did I do that gave this exponential of field series? And basically, if you look very carefully at what has happened, the new condition is whatever an order goes to zero. And that is what Jessup also did. He was asking questions about what if the coefficient in front of the R term in the Eisenhower action, what if that coefficient becomes zero? In ordinary field theories, ordinary theories of gravity, we are not looking at the limit because it's very singular. It's the infinite small distance limit. So the small distance limit normally is outside our reach. Now say, well, not really, in these conformal theories, it's just a special point where omega vanishes. And all I'm asking is that there's nothing special happening there. Just like in the Higgs case, in the Higgs theory, nothing special happens when the Higgs scalar goes to zero. Everything is regular. If not, a theory would no longer be unitary and finally dispersion of the whole thing. The same thing for the omega field, I insist that everything is regular when omega goes to zero. Then, no longer is it allowed, and then the anomalies must stand. So now how does it go? Well, let me just sketch very briefly the problems that you get. You can do you can solve the problem of the beta going to zero in three steps. The first step is look at the gauge field self-interaction, because that's at the lowest loop level. That's only a condition on the gauge couple constant itself. So you can first try to solve that. Now the first beta coefficient vanishes or doesn't vanish depends on the algebra. So they can choose this first coefficient to be very small, and something that does not have an n equals 4 supernode, the second coefficient very big. So in that case, you can find a solution where the fixed point is very close to the origin. It's of the order of n squared. So this k is large if the coefficient here is small, and then you find that g squared is a small number. So g squared is made of order 1 of n squared, where n is the parameter of the gauge group. It is S-U-N or S-O-N. But I like to think of a grand unit theory with S-O-10. So then n is of order 10, and n squared is of order 100. So I have a small coupling constant. It's not g squared n which is small, it's g squared n squared which is small, if n is large. So you really are comfortably in the perturbative domain of the theory. That's where you want to be if you want to be able to compute anything. It's a severe constraint on the algebra, possibly too strong a constraint. So maybe I find no solution at all. because I'm looking too close to the perturbative regime. But that's all I can do. So I take G scat small. And the nice thing is, once you choose G scat small, and all the other copy counts are likely to become small too, and you might find a non-trivial solution. So the next step is to do Yukawa forces. Now there are two kinds of Yukawa forces, the scalar and the pseudo-scalar ones. The pseudo-scalars don't play a very special role. They are probably necessary for the procedure, but I will leave them for a moment as what they are. So that's the greenish terms. Forget them. You say, well, if you look at the Yukawa forces, you find the beta function for the Yukawa forces is proportional to the Yukawa forces themselves, raised to the third power, and terms where you have g squared, the gauge coupling times the Yukawa force in the first power. So if g squared is small, this term is small, and then you find a solution where all the Yukawa couplings are of the order g. So g was small, the Yukawa coupling are also small. This is nice because the signs were not nice in this equation. Usually the opposite signs here, except for the older terms, is really tricky, but you can find, in general, you'll find lots of solutions here. So that looks good. You find your Yukawa couplings that solve
the theorem.
Yes.
I mean, maybe it's you don't want to be asking realistic questions, but what's characteristic of the standard model is the large hierarchy of Yukawa couplings. You
I
have a hope of
that.
Come to that.
The last and last theorem, yes.
Okay.
So I left over the scalar couplings, and the scalar couplings also obey a beta function where all the other things enter as well. Again, if there is a solution, it will be also small, so the scalar couplings will all be of the same order of g. So, and lots of diagrams have to be computed. Actually, the diagrams themselves are trivial to compute, it's just algebra which becomes complicated. So you have a very large set of quantum equations in front of you, and try to find solutions. And usually you find that there are no solutions at all. So, so far the program has not lived in any model that this problem can be carried out. But as Lee correctly pointed out, right away you are heading for a big problem, and that's a hierarchy problem. How come the sum coefficients are so much smaller than the other? If I go through this program, the cosmological constant will also be of the order of g squared or something times g squared times the Planck scale. All the masses will be of order g squared times the Planck mass scale. So everything will be of order of Planck mass. So at very best, I get, you know, models of universe, which are not much bigger than Planck size itself. Bad luck. So now let's see how can we possibly explain the hierarchy problem. How come that I'm going to look for solutions, but some functions are very, very small, in particular, of course, the cosmological term, but also all these mass terms, particularly the mass term for the Higgs field, must be a very, very small number. How can this happen? And that means you have to do something more clever than I've done now. I have no good answer to the hierarchy problem. It's a very deeply important problem in physics, and this just emphasizes how important it is. It's the same problem that drove string theorists to a wall when they came with this landscape. They have to find somehow a point in the landscape where the cosmological constant is 120 orders of magnitude smaller than all the others. Why is that so? That's hard. So I stumbled upon exactly the same difficulty. I have not much better answer. I can try to generate small numbers by taking one of n squared. So one of the n squared is just a group theoretical parameter which easily occurs. So I can make some constant or one over 100. That's not good enough. But maybe some of my algebra is controlled by symmetry-making factors which are controlled by instantons. If that's the case, I have a tunneling phenomenon. And I get e to the minus 100. That's a lot better. So if it's possible, I have not succeeded in doing that. It's just a daydreaming that I'm doing now. If I could make e to the minus 100 also figure out here somewhere in the equations, then I'm done with the hierarchy problem. But no such luck yet. This hasn't succeeded so far. So this is the big mystery that's left over. But I thought it very encouraging that here I got versions of the standard theory where everything in principle should be computable.
May I make
any marks
here? I think the reason you are getting this hierarchy issue is because you are treating perturbation theory without taking the gravitational part into account. Basically, you are doing it in flat space.
Yeah, but I'm okay.
But the remarks that in my talk, the later part of my talk, was that how the, in the cosmological setting, how there is in fact the hierarchy that starts out by assuming a very small cosmological constant, and then the Weak scale becomes.
I cannot assume a small cosmological constant. It has to come up. The cosmological constant also is controlled by.
I know. But my talk was that if you do assume that much, then the electroweak scale compared to the gravitational scale ends up being much smaller. So that was that. So in other words, gravity and cosmology has an input there. And then in this computation, this is not being taken up.
So surely there's things that still have to be done. The G half calculation is very important, but I have other ideas about the G half. And that, of course, has all the fundamental divergences of quantum gravity in it. And I'm quite reluctant to just come to a sort of easy theory for that. I think you have to work much harder to get the G-half part of the theory. So that's why I decided to leave it up all together. See if you can find a separate solution to this problem. Maybe the split up problem into pieces. This would be one piece of the problem. It seemed to be a self-consistency requirement all by itself. Let's look what it gives. That was my lesson. So far, it doesn't tell me what to do with the hierarchy problem, but maybe there are ways out. Not everything has been tried yet.
I mean, as you said, you just look at perturbative data functions, like the non-perturbative contribution.
As soon as your algebra is a little bit less special, then the fixed point are much further away from your algebra. I think the hierarchy problem will get much worse in that. That's what we have to do. I don't know. So, first, it's like the same story with the searching for your lost key on the lamppost. The lamppost is the perturbation spectrum. Let's look there first. That's exactly the observation. Okay, I had some other little example here. Yeah, this is a pet. I'd like to talk about it, but I think my time is over. So, I think I should skip this subject for lead to private discussions, because otherwise it gets too much. I think I've said what I really want to say about conformal gravity and where I am now, but many things I don't understand. Some people have come very smart ideas from this meeting, and I'd love to learn more about those. So maybe there are other alleys to do this, but this is the way I incorporate conformal symmetry into trying to understand from the bits process.
Do you have a conclusion slide that would you show?
I usually don't make a conclusion slide. I don't have a very clear conclusion yet. The conclusion is that I'm not
okay.
Sure. But the conclusion is conformal symmetry is a spontaneously bonded symmetry. And the conformal anomalies should go away somehow. That is very important. And so we try to cancel. In many cases, you can cancel these anomalies. It gives interesting physical information that we should think about. Work is finished, but I split up the problem into sectors. In one sector, I can look at the conformal symmetry. In the conformal anomalies, I understand them. Do a meta sector. Let's look there first, see if you can draw some interesting conclusions. And I think a rather conclusion that standard model parameters are calculable in principle is an interesting conclusion. Many people think they are different in different parts of the universe and so on. I think that's going to be a hard thing to maintain with this result. So I think a couple of concepts are computed. That's not an important issue.
If you do quantum gravity, a Philip Mannheim squared of wild curvature tensor is conformally invariant, it's renormalizable, but you run into trouble. Maybe with unitarity and coasts.
Not maybe.
Yeah.
Well,
I had these discussions with Philip about this, and Lee said it, that there's a severe reason for being skeptical there. what he basically, I think he allows the Riemann tensor to become slightly complex or something like that, and without realizing it, essentially, that he's getting himself in trouble. So I don't believe it's the way to go. I think we have to be much more clever at the Planck scale.
Do you satisfy unitarity?
It's very hard to satisfy unitarity. Of course, in the standard scale, then in the standard model, of course, unitarity is built in from the very beginning. Perturbative theory is constructed entirely around the theme of unitarity and causality. That gives you the prescription how to make standard models. Vector spinners and scalars are nothing else. Throw away those gravity models, they're not going to be unitary. According to the standard model for this. But of course, supergravity people have different ideas.
Gerard?
Yes.
Two quick questions. Do you apply this principle of complementarity not just at horizons of black holes, but at null surfaces generated by accelerated observers? So in other words, would you apply it all over Minkowski space?
Well, I would like to see Richter space, is what you're talking about, as being the large black hole size limit. So they are just large black holes. Large black holes should obey this as much as small ones. So the infinitely large black hole is Richter space, and that should also hold. So in that sense, the answer is yes. But in cosmology, of course, in the Sitter spaces and such, you also have horizons. Mm-hmm. And how to think about those horizons, I haven't made up my mind about that.
Okay, so that leads directly to my second question. Is how do you reconcile the idea of local scale invariance and lack of a scale with the statement in the holographic principle that there's one bit of information per Planck area, which seems to have a fixed scale in it?
Well, yes, it means that probably the information is in the Euler field. So this the Euler field is a physical variable like all the others, and information is a function of that. So information goes back in, well, it's going to be conformally banked, it's going to be in the ratios of field. I think what Barnes did in his talk, he had a function of the ratio of two scalar fields in his interaction. And I think also the information will be in the ratio of these fields. And then you can have that the Planck length, after all, is also not a conformally banked notion, of course.
So that's what I'm worried about.
So, but the ratio field is, so the information of the other fields is not in the fields themselves, in their ratio with this omega field. You can put your information in shapes rather than in the scales as
okay, so that's
so, so I think I understand the question. Maybe I should have to think more about it before answering, but this is my present answer.
Thank you. Let's assume that you find a fixed point of the zero of the beta function. Then I have actually two related questions. First of all, to make contact with the real world, you then have to find the analog of the Higgs mechanism for the spontaneous breaking of the conformal symmetry. Do you know how to do that? And also, if there are more fixed points than one, do you expect tunneling between different theories, since this is a theory of fluctuating metric?
Well, the last question is easy. No, I don't think there's tunneling because you have to be exactly at the fixed time. You can't move around it or something.
So how do you reconcile the continuous breaking point? If you're exactly at the fixed point, how do you?
Well, it should not be solving. The complementarity principle of black holes should be an exact principle, and I should not allow any breaking of the symmetry. Apart from the spontaneous.
Right. My question
so it's like a Higgs mechanism, but in a sense also a bit different. I mean, the Higgs mechanism requires Higgs self potential. I don't need that. So, and that's because the conformal group, of course, is fundamentally different from the gauge group that's bought by Higgs. The gauge group is a rotation, and the Higgs is an invariant surface orbit, if you will, of that gauge group. Of the conformal group is basically all sets of values for the omega field. So omega is 1 is as good a gauge as omega is 25. It doesn't really matter. So I don't need a potential like Higgs potential to be released.
So Is it during the boundary conditions that infinity somehow?
Yes, or rather the definition of what the vacuum state is. In a theory which I have not, did not want to expose here because I didn't take much time, the vacuum is not all such a unique state as you might think. There are very many states which we serve as a model for vacuum. So there's not just one vacuum, there's many vacuums. We choose the state that we see at infinity is by definition a vacuum state. But if it wasn't, we wouldn't be able to talk about it. So we think that I'm totally far away from us, that's basically vacuum space. But that's declared, whatever the order is, that's for us, that's vacuum. So we declare it to be one there. And we get away with it because then we don't see any other curvature space time because we have a vacuum. So that's a boundary condition. And then everything else should follow.
Yeah. In a previous paper of yours a long time ago, when you addressed this U1 problem, I've shown that instantons and at the level of the path of the room already broke the U1 axial symmetry.
Yes.
In the context of conformal symmetry, is it, since you didn't mention instantons in that context, is it possible that also that conformal symmetry might be similarly broken by an instanton?
Well, that is, in the chiral case, as soon as you have a chiral anomaly, it's instanton which breaks the thing explicitly. I think for conformal breaking, it's something of a similar nature. And if you have a conformal instanton, whatever that is, it's likely to break the conformal symmetry explicitly if the theory has an anomaly there. If the theory is anomaly free, then also instantons are not breaking. But talking about the instantons, of course, that's what I was talking about when I was thinking of doing this in the matter sector. Having instantons provide for some symmetry breakings which are not associated to anomalies, but which agree with the conformal symmetry.
So, this is maybe a slightly incoherent question because I'm confused about your argument when you were talking about the gravitational sector of integrating out omega and getting a conformally invariant effective action. Suppose I start with general relativity and I integrate out all of the components of the metric that have an x subscript. Then I'm going to have an effective action that depends on the pieces of the metric that don't have an x direction. Presumably that doesn't mean that I can say, oh, look, space-time is really three-dimensional. Integrating out something doesn't mean that it's not there in the quantum theory unless everything else is independent of it. Right? So I guess I just don't understand what that process of integrating out omega means.
Well, let's think about it in the Higgs mechanism. The Higgs field having its value in say the plus z direction will then tell you what an electron is, what the neutrino is, and so on. Because the other fields are then projected against that Higgs field. Yeah. Now, if I first integrate all the Higgs and have it going around all the gauge choices, then I have no longer any gauge fixing direction. So now the electron and neutrino will degenerate again.
Yeah. So right. So that's my worry of why I don't understand why it makes sense to integrate over omega first.
Exactly. In the very end, that's also not what I'm doing.
Ah,
so
okay.
So it's what I wanted to do, and find that way I should get the conformal invariant theory. But I guess the difficulty that you have is someone bounces into immediately, which is that the group is not a compact group. And that's also presumably what your problem will be if you fix all the x-dependent parts of the metric. Well, you can't, I don't think you can fix them all to zero, but...
No, but, or if you integrate over the Higgs. I mean, that's the kind of problem I'm worrying about, that if you just integrate out omega, then you lose any possibility of spontaneous breaking or gauge.
I think indeed the answer is that in that case, the fact that you are a vacuum does break the symmetry continuously. also means that it's not a very wise thing to do. So I think at the very end, I'd agree with you that that procedure would have no hope of success. So I think I'll be great. It was just the first attempt to say what happens if you first get it all. And it comes something which cannot be told.
Okay.
It would be great to hear part eight if it's only a few minutes.
Okay, so it's a few slides only. If you want to leave, then because this is something of a blasphemy. It's the observation that if you have basic discreteness, and my belief, and this goes back to the black hole picture, the microstates of black hole basically seem to generate a discrete holospace of states, because if black hole is small enough, you can only have finite number of states. So if you look at small volume of space-time, of space, then only a sufficient small black hole fits in there. It has only a limited number of states, finite number of states, which means Hilbert space then, in that section of space-time, is finite. This smells very much like a cellular automaton. A cellular automaton is a system which has a grid, and everything lives in a grid, and you have finite bits of memory in every sector of the grid. And nature then has a law of nature which says that these elements in the grid evolve according to some law. My claim is that evolution could be a deterministic evolution if you do things right. This is a little exercise I've been doing and spending the last couple of weeks on that. And that is, here comes the first part of the argument, the second part comes in the next slide. The first part of the argument consider is all integers, all complex integers, P plus I and Q. When P and Q are integers, so these are double sets or doublets of integers. I can take a Hilbert space spanned by that. That is to say, I take a complete set of states which are spanned by the two integers. So that gives me a basis of Hilbert space. Now, a cellular automaton would be, in this simple expression, would be some computer which tells me that I start at t plus 1 with two integers p and q. At t plus 2, I have two different integers. And I have some laws, some permutation law that tells me what it involves. And then there's a following rather remarkable theorem that if you have that Hilbert space, you can compare the Hilbert space of single p's and q's, which are the quantum mechanical p's and q's with the quantum mechanical computation relations. Now you know that if you have the p's and q's, you can plot p and q, and you get a non-commutative two-dimensional space here. And if you look at it, how much information, or how much is there, or how big is that Hilbert space basically also contains one element of Hilbert, base element of Hilbert space for every little square in there. This square lattice looks very much like this square lattice. Exactly isn't quite the same thing. These things are described what people call wavelets, that you can describe a wave which is more or less oriented, is positioned in space, and has a more or less fixed momentum as well, but limited by the uncertainty relation, of course. But you can take an orthonormal basis of these wavelets on this grid and find a grid of states. That grid of states can be mapped to this grid of states. So then you have some evolution law here, you have evolution law here. That evolution law here is just an ordinary Schrodinger equation. So this turns a cellular automaton into something obeying a Schrodinger equation in one dimension, because I have either Q or P. I'm Hamiltonian in the function of expressing Q variables, or expressing P variables. So the claim is a cellular automaton is not totally different, not totally classical in this sense. I can turn that into a quantum theory. And next task I've been doing is I do the same thing now in higher dimensions. This is the second slide, where in higher dimensions I can do the same thing with a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. And I compare it with a 1 plus 1 dimensional cellular automaton. I have now p's and q's on every side of a 1 dimensional lattice. So I still have a lattice in space, and I have P and Q, so now on every letter size, I have one P and one Q. And I have a law that tells you how these things evolve in time. Now, I compare that with the quantum field theory, also on that same lattice, but now bosons. So fields phi on the same spots. I can play the same trick. I can consider wavelengths in the field direction, say the field phi and the canonical momentum field phi can be mapped onto the cellular automaton. Now, this works completely if both systems have left and right movers going with the speed of light. So I must choose my Hamiltonian on this lattice rather delicately to make sure all left and right movers go with the same speed. But that's, of course, not too difficult to design a Hamiltonian which does that all lattice. It's still a local Hamiltonian in a quantum field sense. The limit of the lattice goes shrinks, lattice size shrinks to zero. This becomes ordinary one-dimensional bosonic field theory. That one-dimensional bosonic field theory again can be mapped onto the one-dimensional cellular automaton. The cellular automaton is not only discrete, it's deterministic. So there's no spread of wave function, anything of the sort. Neither is there here. That's because things go with the speed of light. So you might object that this thing is too simple. It's too simple only because there I can do things exactly mathematically. But in any much more complicated system, I'm sure approximately how the same procedure can work. But there are a certain number of delicate difficulties which stop me from doing this completely. One is the locality of the theory, that your Hamiltonian is an integral of the Hamiltonian density. That is a hard part, but that could be completely solved in this particular case. The remarkable thing here is that in the bosonic field theory, not all states of cellular automaton occur, that's a state missing. And only discovered very recently that there's something missing in here, which makes me suspect that the bosonic theory is not the entire story. You have to add a fermion to it as well. If you add a fermion, you account for the missing state. And that smells a little bit like supersymmetry, that the cellular automaton by itself is equivalent to a theory that has one boson and one fermion living on the lattice. And there's no need for the fermion to be degenerate in the boson, so maybe there's interesting ways out of supersymmetry, but you do have fermions and bosons in the system. By itself, fermions would be a cellular automaton that doesn't have p's and q's, only ones and zeros on the lattice. Normally, the fermion would correspond to ones and zeros moving along the lattice, but that was exactly the one state which was missing in this procedure. So
the boson is massless, the fermion doesn't have.
They're all massless. Sorry?
Then there would be symmetric.
They're not?
The theory is symmetric. The boson massless.
Yes,
and
it would
automatically
be symmetric perfectly, of course. Yes. So, but one is it also a perturbation? One can now modify cellular automaton and show that corresponds to a modification of the quantum field theory. And then you get interacting quantum field theories. Possibly even with mass term and everything, so now you've got a much richer system. Not all that I could do with any mathematical rigor, but this part now is pretty long with mathematical rigor, and I like that I can tell you actually looks very difficult. So this is one step towards getting field theories as a result of deterministic systems. It's my belief that at Planck's law something like this is happening, that you have a deterministic evolution of local laws, discarded black holes and whatnot, but the only way to scale that, to span a model scale, is 20 orders of magnitude away from that. The only way to get that is by first turning the cellular automaton to a quantum field theory, then apply the renormalization group, which you can apply to the quantum system, and then you end up with something which is like this kind of model, where all the instances of determinism has got lost. The determinism only acts at the scale of the Planck scale. So yeah, I have no access to the Planck scale in LHC experiments, so we don't notice any determinism in the ordinary standard model. So that's why I'm thinking more carefully about the G-hat integration. I think the G-hat is the thing in which has to process information in a discrete manner somehow. So G-hat is probably a simplification that we believe in at the standard model scale, something like that. But at the Planck scale, it's really something more discrete and deterministic. So,
what do you say about Bell theorem?
It's the usual problem with Bell theorem. I think that the people who have objections based on Bell's theorem should look at the model. Because in the model I'm using quantum states, the quantum states don't obey any Bell theorem at all. But nevertheless, it's mathematically written to a lot of deterministic system. So this way I might not have my cake and eat it. So it's quantum mechanics.
So it's not a classical model.
It's not totally classical. It's describing the quantum states, but the local dynamics is totally deterministic.
So it's a quantum cellular automaton?
No, it's a classical cellular automaton. So the bottom line is nature is deterministic.
Yeah.
But we can't describe it at a standard scale in terms of deterministic. Degrees of freedom have this kind of using quantum wave functions. And those quantum wave functions don't care at all about those important.
I'm not sure how you get around Bell's thing.
I know, it's an eternal discussion. I'm sure they'll still see this thing tomorrow morning.
Well, maybe this is easier than Bell's theorem, maybe not. In your simple quantum mechanical model, I can take a superposition of two wavelets at different points. What's the physical interpretation of that in the cellular
quantum? In the cellular quantum, the wave function is only a mathematical way to describe probabilities. And at the level of cellular quantum, only the squares of the wave function mean something. They mean probabilities, the chances of quantum in this state. That's it. The phases mean absolutely nothing, but I can still define those wave functions to say how they evolve, and they have directly they mean something itself in the quantum field. But there again, phases usually don't mean anything.
But certainly, if I add in the quantum theory, if I add two wavelets with different phases, and then take the modulus square to get probabilities, I'll get probabilities that depend on the relative.
But I can tell you, I can do it the other way around. I can take the quantum field theory and say that it is a automaton in disguise. Mm-hmm. And once I see that in that basis, also the quantum field theory, phases mean nothing. The phases don't ever materialize into something that you can observe. So, and that's because you have only quantum mechanics. In most wave functions, you can never see the phases. Only in very special cases, if you do a very special interference experiment, you can make those phases observable. In that particular case, those phases aren't phases anymore, they're still empty by the time you observe it. So,
I guess because they're orthogonal. I guess because your wavelets are orthogonal.
Yes.
So, yeah,
yes.
Okay. Okay.
So if there are no more questions.